Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from New York State United Teachers, working to support students, educators, and public schools as the center of their communities through the Public Schools Unite Us initiative, and United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org. New York Governor Kathy Hochul convened a youth mental health roundtable this week at Gilderland High School in Albany County. The Legislative Gazette's Dave Lucas was there and filed this report.
Hochul says the session kicks off a statewide listening tour to address smartphone use in schools.
I just met with parents, educators, local leaders, advocates, to hear from them about the challenge of cell phones in schools and how they impact our children's education. And talking about, is this actually the kind of environment we want to have for our children to continue to learn in? 2 years ago, I started holding mental health listening sessions with teenagers to find out why the rates of suicide, depression, anxiety were so high for them. We came to the conclusion that addictive social media algorithms were affecting the mental health of children and teens in a significant way. In fact, the Surgeon General of the United States came to the same conclusion. Those listening sessions here in New York led us to take on the social media companies.
In June, the governor signed two bills to regulate social media. The bills make it illegal for social media companies to use addictive algorithms for users under 18 and prevent companies from collecting and selling children's personal data without parental consent. Supporters of the legislation say social media apps negatively impact the mental health of young people. Hochul cited a Pew Research poll released in June that finds 72% of high school teachers nationwide say that students being distracted by cell phones is a major problem in their classroom.
Same study found that 95% of 13 to 17-year-olds have access to smartphones, and they're receiving over 250 notifications per day on average. So, a couple of observations. I am the first mom governor of New York. I'm hardwired to worry about our children and their safety, of course. But it's also impossible to ignore the reality that this generation, more than others, is being subjected to distractions that never existed the way they are now. There's a screen flashing in their face. They're experiencing FOMO. Are they missing out on something at this very moment?
Fellow Democrat Albany Mayor Kathy Sheehan says all of the evidence points to the fact that action is needed to make sure students are not distracted by cell phones.
One of the interesting things that we talked about was this idea that somehow our kids need cell phones so that they can be safe, so that they can be connected to their parents. And really nothing could be further from the truth. Their safety, their mental health safety, I think is paramount. And all of the indicators are showing that cell phones, the distractions, the cyberbullying, the types of isolation that happens because of the fixation on phones is harming our children, and it's time that we do something about it.
Another study by Common Sense Media found children between the ages of 11 and 17 are on their phones, on the average, 4.5 hours a day. Hochul says she's impressed by existing policy in the Schoharie School District, which has totally banned all distractions in school.
No earbuds. No smartwatches, no smartphones, and no flip phones. They started this policy 2 years ago. They ran into a lot of opposition, anxious parents who felt that they need to be connected with their children throughout the day, but they brought in law enforcement and let the parents hear from law enforcement that if the parents' worst nightmare actually occurs, that there's an active shooter on site and their children are in harm's way, something that every parent since Columbine has had in the back of their mind when they send their children off to school, that actually children are less safe in that environment when they're distracted with a cell phone in an incident like that, as opposed to following the leaders of the adults who are trained to know what to do.
Schoharie Central School District Superintendent David Blanchard.
There's a real clear connection between what we see when students have access to their cell phones and, you know, how they react, you know, to different things that occur during the school day when they have full access to a phone. In other words, you know, there can be anxiety-producing events that kids all of a sudden see while they're in a classroom. They could be exposed to another student who's having a bad day. All things that disrupt the learning environment and do not help them to be as mentally healthy as possible while they're trying to learn.
Hochul says months of discussions with school officials are planned to establish rules and regulations for students and cell phones, and promises that as the listening tour continues, she will use gathered information to shape a statewide policy proposal to be announced later this year.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Dave Lucas. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. This week, I sat down with New York State Assembly Majority Leader Crystal Peoples-Stokes. I asked her about the legal cannabis industry, something she supported for a long time and something that's been criticized in terms of its slow rollout. I asked her why it took so long.
I want to say our act was never not together. What it was brand new, a new agency, a new bureaucratic agency, by the way. And we just did not give it the proper, I want to say, resources of staffing and that it needed to get off the ground. And I'm saying staffing with expertise, not staffing that was just hired fresh and said, okay, go do this. I want to say there's multiple agencies within the state who could have sent in their top-tier IT people, their top-tier recruiters, their top-tier lawyers. They could have sent in a top-tier from every agency in the state to help pull this brand-new agency together, but we didn't do that. I notice I'm saying we, even though it's not a legislative agency, it's an administrative agency. But we didn't do that. And because we didn't, we allowed things to drag along so slow that it gave the, I would say, opposition, and I don't say opposition because they don't want legalized cannabis to happen, but the opposition to social equity, a chance to fester. And while they festered, they introduced lawsuits, they put out negative information, they set up all sort of online news outlets, again, spewing negative news about social equity. They took out full-page ads against the governor, slamming her for things that, how could you slam somebody for something that, one, they didn't vote for. Two, they're trying to get implemented, and what you should be trying to do is trying to help them and not politicize it by bringing them down. All of these things they did, not because they don't think cannabis should be legal. They did it because they would like to have access to that first. Not social equity first. Not farmers first. Not New York small businesses first. They wanted access first. They didn't get it, and so they helped delay the process of starting a new agency in a bureaucratic system in the state of New York. That notwithstanding, New York still ends up being the state in America with more social equity, I'm going to say straight black and brown people with license, than anywhere else in the country. And you can combine every state across the nation if you like, and you will not meet the numbers that have been met in New York State. That's even before the exit of the executive director. So I'm going to just imagine that under the new interim director and the search that they have on now for a new director, that's only going to get better. I'm going to have to imagine that.
And will we see some numbers? You know, I keep asking the comptroller, how much are we getting? What numbers do we have from legal cannabis benefiting the state coffers? Is there anything written in that law that you're keeping track of the numbers here?
Well, the state comptroller keeps track of all numbers, doesn't he?
I don't know. Like I said, I asked him. He's not in favor of marijuana. That's not his thing. But I don't see any numbers coming from anywhere. I have, you know, you see these other states. They report how many millions they've made. You see town by town in Massachusetts how they do. I'd like to be able to see some numbers, you know, like on the casino industry. We've seen that. On the new legal marijuana industry. That's all.
You know what? I'd like to see that as well. And I mean, if he's not necessarily looking at how you come up with those numbers, let's just look at the number of people who have jobs that didn't need a permit.
Yeah, all those numbers would be great.
Didn't need a license.
Yeah.
Lawyers, these new online publications that are popping up all over the place. Graphic artists, people who sell lighting equipment for growth purposes.
Sure.
There's all sorts of people who are making money because of the legalization that does not require a license and is not necessarily regulated. So there's money being made.
Sure. Love to hear what it is.
Maybe I'll add my voice to yours and see if the controller can put those down in black and white for us.
That would be fantastic.
That's New York State Assembly Majority Leader Crystal Peoples Stokes. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. Lawmakers in New York's Hudson Valley are condemning the assassination attempt on former President Donald Trump in Pennsylvania. The Legislative Gazette's Jesse King with more.
After being injured in the ear, Trump has since arrived in Milwaukee for the Republican National Convention, where delegates are expected to officially nominate him for president. On a virtual press conference Monday, Congressman Mark Molinaro of the 19th District joined other New York Republicans in denouncing the shooting. Molinaro says in addition to the FBI's investigation, the House plans to investigate how the alleged shooter got by the Secret Service in the first place.
President Trump came within just half an inch and perhaps only seconds from assassination. And we know without question that there was a colossal failure of security and a breach in those security protocols.
The incident has forced at least a temporary pause in the hostilities between President Biden and Trump's campaigns in what was already a tumultuous race marked by Trump's guilty verdict on several criminal charges in New York and calls from some Democrats for Biden to step aside after his disappointing performance in a recent debate. In a rare televised address Sunday, Biden called for Americans to reject political violence and, quote, cool down before November. In New York's 17th District, Republican Congressman Mike Lawler says he and Democratic Congressman Richie Torres are introducing a bipartisan measure to boost Secret Service security for Biden, Trump, and independent Robert F. Kennedy Jr. Lawler spoke on NPR.
One of the main takeaways that I think we all need to have as Americans is that our elections are determined by votes at a ballot box, not by violence at a rally. And it's really, it is a sad day in America when it has come to this, that, you know, someone would try to take action into their own hands and upend our nation.
Elsewhere in the Hudson Valley, Democratic Congressman Pat Ryan of the 18th District thanked the Secret Service in the aftermath of the attack, adding, quote, "Let me be clear and unequivocal as possible. There is no excuse whatsoever for political violence," end quote. Westchester County Executive George Latimer, a Democrat who is running for the 16th Congressional District, described the incident as, quote, "simply awful," adding in part, quote, "We will learn more about a 20-year-old boy who hasn't yet voted for president but felt it proper to try to kill one," end quote. Others denounced the violence include New York Governor Kathy Hochul, state lawmakers like Senator Rob Rollison and State Senator James Skoufis, and local officials like Rockland County Executive Ed Day and Ulster County Executive Jem Metzger. The Orange County Sheriff's Office urged residents to remain vigilant and report any suspicious events to law enforcement. Some New York lawmakers, however, blamed the Biden campaign in the immediate aftermath of the shooting. Congressman Nick LaLota of the 1st District on Long Island accused Biden of telling supporters to, quote, put Trump in a bullseye in the days before the attack, while Congresswoman Claudia Tenney of the 24th District referred to Biden as the, quote, same evil guy threatening President Trump and also denying Secret Service to Robert F. Kennedy Jr., end quote. Asked if he feels Trump has contributed to the vitriol with his own rhetoric over the years, the former president, after all, was impeached for his role in the attack on the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021. Molinaro says no one's hands are clean.
Everyone has a role to play in dialing it down. Everyone has played a role at times in accelerating some of the rhetoric. You know, it's like most things. I don't know where the line is as in mass, but I know where it is for me. And I'm hopeful that my colleagues in elected office, candidates for office, and others know that there is a line and try to stay on the right side of it.
Trump has reportedly changed his convention speech for Thursday night to include more messages of unity. In other election news Monday, a federal judge in Florida dismissed a case against Trump regarding his mishandling of classified documents, saying special counsel Jack Smith was illegally appointed. On his social media site, Trump quickly posted a statement blasting Biden, the justice system, and others. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Jesse King.
Two upstate New York prisons are closing. Democratic Governor Kathy Hochul's administration announced this week that Great Meadow Correctional Facility in Washington County and Sullivan Correctional Facility in Fallsburg will shutter November 6th. The Legislative Gazette's Lucas Willard reports.
The state budget signed by Governor Kathy Hochul in April allowed for the closure of up to five state correctional facilities. The legislation states that at least 90 days' notice would be given for the closures that are determined necessary for cost savings and efficiency. The State Department of Corrections and Community Supervision cites a dramatic decline in prison population. The department says it reviewed operations at 44 correctional facilities before the announcement. Matt Kew, vice president of the New York State Correctional Officers and Police Benevolent Association Union, says he was informed of the closures on Wednesday.
Myself and President Summers were notified yesterday that we were to be at Commissioner Daniel Marticello III's office. He's the Commissioner of Corrections, along with leaders from PEF and CSEA and the Council 82, the Lieutenants Union, and they informed us that they were closing the following facilities: Great Meadow Correctional Facility and Sullivan Correctional Facility.
Q says NYSCOPA represents 475 corrections officers and 33 sergeants at Great Meadow and 269 corrections officers and 20 sergeants at Sullivan. The announced closure at Great Meadow comes a decade after the shuttering of Mount McGregor, a former state facility in neighboring Saratoga County, and 2 years after Moriah Shock in Essex County closed.
There are officers that transferred from Moriah Shock to Great Meadow. I personally know some of them, and now they're going to be displaced again.
Republican State Assembly member Matt Simpson, whose 114th district includes Great Meadow, says hundreds of families will be affected.
There's over 600 people that are direct, 600 families that are being directly impacted by this news, this announcement of closure. That's not counting all of the other people that are impacted, businesses that are currently working there, labor unions. I mean, we have steam fitters and pipe fitters there. We have electricians.
Docs says all staff will be offered employment at other state facilities. A statement from the department says the decision to close these facilities was a difficult one for all involved, and that correctional agencies across the country continue to struggle to meet staffing demands, and the department is no exception despite new and aggressive recruitment efforts. Republican State Senator Jake Ashby of the 43rd District says the Hochul administration did not consider the impacts to local economies in making its decisions.
Think of this. We're leading the nation in outward migration. We have exceptional population loss here. And what are we doing in upstate? We're gutting local economies.
Ashby, who said he discussed the closure with Town of Salem officials Thursday afternoon, hopes to have more community conversations.
I would imagine that myself and Senator Steck, Assemblyman Matt Simpson, Kerry Warner, we will be coming together, and I would suspect we are going to be doing some outreach on this.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Lucas Willard.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. In ninth grade, Luke Basso began documenting the stories of veterans. He created a YouTube channel to preserve the experiences of soldiers who served from World War II to current conflicts. And Basso skipped his high school graduation this year to go to Normandy for the 80th anniversary of D-Day. He tells the Legislative Gazette's Pat Bradley he's always had an interest in history.
I've always liked history, especially military and political history. It wasn't until 2021 in ninth grade when I started my YouTube channel, Film Puria, to interview veterans to preserve their stories. I originally wanted to get the last living Korean and World War II veterans, but there's barely any of them left. There's barely any of them left. So I've had veterans from all conflicts, and not just veterans. I've had Holocaust survivors or victims of communism on my channel.
As a student, you could have just gone and talked to them and learned about them yourself, but you've actually done videos and put it on YouTube so that other people can see or hear their stories. How did this grow? How did this become a continuing project?
Well, I never planned on stopping this. I never planned on stopping this at all. It was just more of an in-the-moment thing. I wanted to preserve these veteran stories. And it goes back when it was first a thought. But to go back to the late 2020, I met with Doug Brown. He's a World War II veteran. I wanted to meet him. So there was a parade going on for him about his birthday, I think his 100th birthday. I wanted to meet him, but there was so much happening that day. So the family said, hey, come back tomorrow. You can meet him. So I came back the next day. There's two cameras set up, and the family recorded my conversation with him. And I'm thinking, okay, why don't I can do the same thing. I like making videos. I like film. I like history. I like the military. I like current events. I love all this kind of stuff. So one thing led to another. I got film equipment in 2021, and I started my YouTube channel. And ever since then, I've had people from all over the world on Zoom or in person. Not just American veterans. I've had other veterans on my channel, too, or people with historical significance. Most of them say no. I get why these people don't want to talk about this stuff. I get it. War is a terrible thing. Why would you want to recall those terrible memories? But they realize that the significance of sharing these stories for the world to see, especially with a lot of the older veterans, they understand what I'm doing and why I'm doing it.
Why do you believe it's important to record and preserve their stories?
There's barely any World War II and Korean War veterans left. Then people need to know what it's like from their point of view, not from like a movie or a textbook or just history class. These are firsthand accounts, and you can know what actually happened and the truth, what actually happened. And some, you know, it's very important for these people to have their stories shared. So people know what they went through. A lot of people do not know what these people have went through.
I looked up, and there they were putting the flag up. Ultimately, the executive officer, the guy in command of the Marines, said they ought to put up a bigger flag. And that one, when that was put up, they took pictures, and that appeared in a magazine. And that's the one that you see is the symbol of World War II.
When the medics came with the stretcher, the three of us, we went to a tent, the other ones, they were wounded, they were crying and hollering, and we helped the others. And then I happened to look to see who's next. I said, oh my gosh, there was a soldier there, he was decapitated. So I didn't look no more, I went to another. But we got hit so bad, and I cannot forget this. Every night, 70-some years, I still think of it. We lost a lot of good soldiers. But like I say, we didn't know what we were doing. We were only kids. I was only 19 then, and it was hard. We went through a lot.
You are capturing a range of memories, and some of them are quite graphic. Were you surprised? Did you get emotional, too, sometimes with what these veterans were telling you about their experiences?
Sometimes I get surprised at how open they'll be. Sometimes a lot of these veterans have never spoken about their experiences ever in their lives. And then I come along, they met me very recently, they barely know me, and they're okay sharing their story to some high schooler rather than their family members or their friends.
Luke Basso, you decided not to attend your high school graduation because you decided to go to the commemoration in Normandy this year. What was that like?
That was a one-of-a-lifetime experience at the 80th anniversary D-Day. I know there will never be another D-Day anniversary like this ever again. There's barely any World War II veterans left. They're almost 100 years old. And I'm very grateful that I went to this. I really am. There's people from all over the world I met. There's flags from all the Allied nations everywhere. Everything there represented D-Day. And the French people at Normandy, they're so grateful for the Americans and the Allies who liberated them from 4 years of Nazi oppression.
Did you get a chance to record or interview any of the veterans while you were there?
No, it was pretty hard to do that when there's so much happening all at once. But I got to meet a lot of World War II veterans and other veterans from other conflicts too. So I got their contact information. Hopefully I can Zoom call them in the future, or at least stay in touch with these people, because I made a lot of good friends when I was there.
How do you think the interviews that you've done have affected you?
Oh, I learn a lot. I learn a lot. And I mean a lot. I don't want to repeat myself, but I do. Not just from their point of view, but I could learn background knowledge of historical conflicts, even lesser known ones, or even not just from their point of view, but the overall context. I get to hear just what it was really like. When you read these textbooks, or when you watch a movie or watch a documentary, they make it so cut and dry. It's not cut and dry. And there's a lot of what goes on behind the scenes that people do not know about at all. So hearing from these veterans, from boots-on-the-ground soldiers to commanders, none of it's cut and dry. It is not cut and dry. There's a lot of what goes on behind the scenes that no one talks about. So hearing this, I learned a lot about all these conflicts.
Luke Basso has recorded about 100 interviews and so far has uploaded nearly 70 online. Basso began his project while living in Chazy, New York, and moved to North Carolina last year. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Pat Bradley.
And that about does it for this week's show. The Legislative Gazette is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. We had help from the New York Public News Network. You can listen to the Legislative Gazette anytime at wamcpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. Look for program number 2429. And join us again next week at this same time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Gustino. Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org.